Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It seems like every day there's a new study that says the planet is heating up and we're to blame. But it's hard to really understand how each one of us as individuals contributes to the problem just by getting through our busy days and enjoying the fruits of prosperity. Well, we're about to find out. This hour On Point, the human footprint, how each individual American leaves a mark on the planet. Joining me now from New York City is Elizabeth Vargas. She is co-host of ABC News 2020. She's also the host of the National Geographic special, The Human Footprint, which will premiere this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Hi, Elizabeth. Nice to have you.
Nice to talk to you, Jane.
So how do you measure the average person's human footprint?
Well, the staff at National Geographic spent a lot of time sort of assembling statistics. There are all sorts of numbers out there that are readily available. But bottom line, measuring what the average American uses and discards in his or her lifetime. 77 years, 9 months, that's the average lifespan of the average American. And I'm putting the emphasis here on American because it's different from the Brits or the French. Dramatically different from some of our cohorts, co-human beings African continent, for example. An average American baby by the age of 12 months will have been responsible for as much carbon dioxide emissions as a Tanzanian is in his or her entire life.
Just by the diapers they wear.
Well, that really resonated for me. I still have
too.
One of my children in diapers.
I
think you do too,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah.
But that was an incredible statistic to look at it because a child over 2.5 years will use nearly 4,000 diapers. That's an average of a little more than four a day. I've had a couple people tell me my child uses more than four diapers a day. But that is the average. And to make those diapers takes, you know, an enormous amount of crude oil, half a pint of crude oil per diaper to make that plastic waterproof lining. Over 30 months, a single diaper baby will use 715 pounds of plastics in that plastic lining. And that soft, fluffy padding on the inside of the diapers requires the pulp of 4.5 enormous trees. That's just for one American toddler.
Right, and so I think, well, a cloth diapers may be the alternative. But as we see in the human footprint, no, no.
Well, there is a footprint there as well. I mean, one of the first questions I asked National Geographic when they came to me with this project was, is this going to have a message? Are we going to be judgmental? Are we going to, you know, wag our fingers at the audience and say, don't do this and you should do that? Because I'm not sure people – that's the most effective way to get people to realize the implications of their behavior and perhaps modify and change that behavior. But you're absolutely right. Your natural inclination when you hear about those plastic diapers, those disposable diapers, and by the way – it takes, we estimate, 500 years for each of those diapers to decompose and completely, you know, fall apart in a landfill. And we're only guesstimating because diapers haven't been around that long. But you're right. To go and switch to cloth diapers means you will actually use 22,455 gallons of water over 2.5 years, which is enough to fill an average swimming pool.
Let's listen to an excerpt from the opening minutes of the documentary Human Footprint. Here you are. Here's Elizabeth Vargas trying to explain how little things add up.
This is our world, a finite place of infinite possibilities. It's been around for over 3.8 billion years. If we think of the Earth as being one day old, then we've been around for just a few seconds. Yet, with over 6 billion of us on the planet, our presence is earth-shaking. As individuals, we may think we have little impact on the world around us. We may feel that our contribution to the world goes unnoticed. We'd be wrong. Each of us makes a contribution. We each make an impact. And we each leave a footprint.
So the human footprint, Elizabeth, is determined not only by the food we eat and the oil that's used to power our cars, but also the resources that are needed to package and transport everything we consume. And what I found fascinating is how you follow the chain of production to find out what goes into the making of what we use every day, from T-shirts to soda cans to laptop computers. Give us an example of that, would you?
Well, you don't think about it day to day. But, for example, a lot of us, when we look inside of our cotton T-shirts, we'll see made in China there. What you don't factor into the footprint of that little simple T-shirt is not only the cotton that is grown, but then it's, in many cases, flown to China, where it is assembled in a factory, made in a factory, and then flown back to the United States. Many things that we use, that we wear, cars, you know, the parts of our cars come from all over the globe. It's an unbelievable thing to think about. Before we've ever bought that brand new item in the store, it's often traveled all the way around the world several times. And that uses, obviously, it's on an airplane, it's on a ship, it uses fuel to get there and back. So when you really start to break it down, it can be almost overwhelming. Aside from that, Jane, we just have the sheer numbers. I mean, it was an unbelievable thing to me to find out that the average American drinks 43,371 cans of soda in his or her lifetime.
Right.
178 million cans of soda get popped open across the country every single day. That's 2,000 cans of soda a second.
And 19,826 eggs. And there was one of the great visual moments in the documentary is, you know, behind each egg, there's a whole backstory, the vast industries
right.
that are created to produce it.
Right. One of my producers at ABC, because we're also doing a piece on the human footprint tomorrow night on 2020, said to me, well, I didn't know we all drank 168 pints of milk a year, adding up to nearly, you know, to 13,056 pints over a lifetime. He said, I don't drink that much milk. And I said, wait a minute. Milk is in yogurt. Milk. You have milk in your coffee, in your cereal. It's in your ice cream. It's in cakes. It's used in a lot of different ways that you might not think about. So what we're hoping tonight is to show all the people, not just the aggregate, because you mentioned the eggs just a minute ago. It's almost, you know, I find it almost nauseating to see all those eggs being dumped in one fell swoop. It's an unbelievable visual to see and think, that's what I'm going to eat over my entire lifetime. You know, we take it a step further, as you said. We talk about what goes into the transportation and packaging alone is responsible for an enormous amount of waste that, you know, that we Americans generate. We're sort of singular in this. We're only 5% of the world's population, but we use 25% of the world's oil. We are the most wasteful people on the planet. We triple wrap everything in plastic. It must be hermetically sealed. And all that plastic goes inside another plastic garbage can that then goes to the landfill where it sits for decades.
Let's listen to a clip from the program, Elizabeth, about packaged foods and the huge problem that they are. Take a listen.
We devour our foods in packages. Foods from the microwave. Foods we can grab on the run. We need between 1,500 and 2,000 calories each day to propel us through our busy lives. And as a nation, we eat a total of over 1.5 billion pounds of food every day.
And all that packaging, Elizabeth, creates a lot of trash. And I must say that the most fascinating and disturbing numbers are about how much trash the average American will get rid of in their lifetimes.
Well, one of the stand-ups that I did in the special, they have me standing in front of a dump truck as it actually dumps the amount of garbage a single American will generate in a lifetime. And so I'm standing in front of this thing thinking, okay, there's my garbage. and as it's dumping out behind me, and it's really striking. It's striking because if you've had the chance I'm an Army brat, so I grew up overseas. My job takes me all over the world to many places and many countries. And so I've seen how other people do live very differently from Americans. But even, you know, our friends in Europe who have a quality of life very similar to ours, they don't go to grocery stores in general and buy everything triple plastic wrapped as we do. And that's one of the first things, the easy things that we can start to change in our life to hopefully have, that could have a big impact on what we're just throwing out every day.
64 tons of waste per person to landfills over our lifetime. I'm looking some of the stats from your documentary. Americans throw out 11 million tons of glass bottles every year. That's the same weight as 440 Titanics or 30 Empire State Buildings put together.
It's pretty unreal.
Yeah.
It's pretty unreal. And those aluminum soda cans, getting back to the soda that we were just talking about, you know, most of them, a lot of people would love to recycle, but recycling, and I'm certainly our guest, Mike, who's here with us today, can talk about that as well. Eric, who's sitting next to me. But, you know, people would like to do, in a lot of cases, the right thing. In a lot of cities around the country, you see people taking their canvas shopping bags to the grocery store so there isn't at least one more plastic bag that's being used. But it's going to come, I think, from the groundswell up. People have to start insisting that, you know, can you do this differently? Can we, you know, just put the fish in one piece of paper and wrap it up instead of three pieces of plastic, which, you know, will take forever to biodegrade?
I'm curious, after seeing all of this and, gosh, from how much we use to build our homes to the cleaning supplies that we use to the food that we eat to the trash that we've already mentioned, I'm wondering what the impact on your own life has been as you have been going through and producing this documentary.
Well, I've become an enormous nag to everybody in my household about turning off lights and unplugging appliances. That's certainly true. And we were already a family of recyclers before I did this project. You know, I think living in Manhattan, this is a city that does recycle and makes it easy to recycle. And it was interesting. I know, Jane, you used to live here as well, but we did a piece for Tomorrow Night's 2020 on green houses yeah. that are made completely of recycled or sustainable materials and have a zero energy, zero carbon footprint. And the developer of these homes said that actually Manhattan, of all places, is a pretty because we live in houses that were already built and already used, our footprint is a little bit smaller than you would expect.
Ah, interesting. So, this is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the human footprint, the mark that each one of us leaves on the planet. I've been joined from New York City by Elizabeth Vargas, co-host of ABC's 2020 and the host of a National Geographic special presentation called Human Footprint, which airs this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I'd like now to bring another voice into the discussion. Also from New York is Dr. Eric Sanderson, associate director of the Living Landscapes Program of the Wildlife Conservation Society. He was part of the team that created, in 2002, the Human Footprint Map of the World and was an advisor on this documentary. Nice to have you, Dr. Sanderson.
Hi, Jane.
So as a scientist, what was your reaction to the human footprint, the impact of consumption from one human life?
Well, you know, at the Wildlife Conservation Society, we work with places all over the world to try and figure out how human beings are impacting wildlife in wild places. We have projects in over 60 different countries. And what we do in those places is think about how individual actions lead to the threats to wildlife. And so several years ago, as part of that, I worked with scientists at Columbia University to develop a map of the cumulative human footprint. So if you add up all of our individual footprints as individual people, as individual Americans, as Americans as part of the global population, the whole population of humanity on Earth, then you get to our human footprint, and it creates this map that shows that 83% of the land surface is influenced by human beings.
And 98%.
83%, that's right, is influenced by one or more of these factors. So we added up maps of human population density, of land use, of access from roads and rivers and railways, and lights that you can see from a satellite at night. So just those four factors alone influence 83% of the land surface and 98% of the places where it's possible to grow rice, wheat, or corn.
So with 83% of the Earth's surface then impacted or encroached upon by humans, can you push back the human footprint?
Yeah, I think we can. I think we can push it back, and I also think we can transform it. Right. So oftentimes we hear these terrible stories about what human beings are doing are impacting the way the natural world works. But I don't think it has to be that way. You know, we each have to consume what we need to consume. You know, people or organisms were animals just like other kinds of animals or plants too on the planet that each have their basic needs for food and for water and for shelter. And to have the resources we need to raise our kids. And those needs are totally appropriate and they need to be met. But it leads to this big question, right, which I think people are left with at the end of the film is, okay, so we have a world with 6.6 billion people on it.
And growing.
And growing, that's right. You know, estimates of 10 to 12 billion people by the end of the century. So how are we going to supply the basic needs for these people, for food and water and shelter and to raise our kids and not wreck the natural systems of the planet that we all depend on? right? Well, I mean, that seems to me to be the biggest question of the 21st century.
Well, it seems with these numbers, though, that this kind of consumption is not really sustainable. So is there a calculation as to say, you know, at what point we're going to run out of resources?
It's not sustainable. I mean, E.O. Wilson a couple of years ago made a calculation that if everyone in the world consumed at the rate that Americans do, it would take four Earths, four planets to supply those resources. So clearly, American lifestyles are fed by an unsustainable consumption of resources that needs to change. And I think it's going to have to change. And it's going to have to change in our lifetimes.
Talk about that a little bit more as far as what we consume. Elizabeth alluded to it earlier. But how do we compare in the United States to other countries around the world?
Well, we're very dramatic consumers. We're the most consumptive society that the world has ever seen, frankly. You know, Paul Ehrlich said that human impact on the environment is population times consumption times impact. And we live in a world where there's more people, right? And in America, we have the highest consumptive rates that the world has ever seen with the technologies that the world has never seen, right? So these are four historically unprecedented factors, and you multiply them together, and it creates this human footprint, which is brand new in the world, right? No one species has ever impacted the world so much as we do and we have today. And so the question is, how are we going to transform that human footprint? You know, how are we going to find these solutions? And part of the solutions, I think, will be at the individual level, but part of those will be at larger levels, at the levels of people as groups, whether in businesses and corporations or as governments or as social society, as civil society, as Elizabeth was alluding to before.
Well, what's a person to do? What's a consumer to do? You know, when you go to the market, you go to the grocery store, you're standing in the checkout line and, you know, the first question, paper or plastic? You know, we sort of march to the beat of a culture that doesn't seem concerned or that's sort of ready-made to take us in the wrong direction.
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing to say is that it's a really hard thing, right? So we're talking about very big things. And this film is putting across some very big ideas. It does it in a way that's a little bit light and kind of interesting and fun to watch. But you're left with a really big thing to have to deal with. And the human footprint on the planet is a really big thing. And so, you know, I think it's really important up front to acknowledge that, right? And they're all – it creates this sort of, I think, cognitive dissonance, right, that the people are just going about their lives, you know, getting the food they need at the grocery store or driving their car to work. They're not meaning to be destructive or problematic, and yet we know in America because of climate change and because of all the things that come before climate change and we're still talking about, that, in fact, we're having this global impact. And so what I think happens is psychological defenses come into play. You know, when you can't really manage, you know, something that's really hard to take on, you know, this cognitive dissonance, what happens is sometimes people deny it. And we went through a long phase of denial about climate change that we're kind of breaking through now. Some people get very angry. Some people blame other people. They transfer it. You know, they say it's not me. It's the corporations. It's other people. It's other things that are outside of me. We're seeing a lot of that in the way the rest of the world thinks about America now. And there's depression. There's just like, you know, despair, and I can't do it, so I'm just going to continue to do what I've done, what I've always done.
But, Jane, there are some small things that people can do that can make a difference, because that is it is important to sort of counteract the throw-your-hands-in-the-air attitude of, I can't change it, so I'm not going to change anything in my life. When they do say paper or plastic at the grocery store, you should have your own, you know, bag that you bring with you and say, put it in my bag. Adjusting your thermostat just 2 degrees in the winter and the summer can do quite a lot to save. Having one energy-saving, just one energy-saving light bulb in your house, if we had one in every single American home, we would save enough energy to light more than 3 million homes a year and save more than $600 million in annual energy costs and prevent greenhouse gases equivalent to the emissions of more than 800,000 cars. So it's important not to think, well, this problem is so big I can't do anything about it. And likewise, it's important not to say, well, in China and in India, they're, you know, putting up coal plants left and right and they're polluting left and right. And, you know, why should we bother to do something in the United States? Everybody else is, you know, no matter what we do, the problem is still going to grow and continue elsewhere. We're leaders in this. Everybody in the world wants to live like Americans, for better or for worse. And I think as a country, if perhaps we set a political and social example, others will be more likely to follow. We'll never convince the governments of other countries to make the hard decisions and to make the sacrifices to be more environmentally friendly if we haven't done it first ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's so true. You know, we need to bring that sort of can-do attitude of America, right, and that creativity that's essential to what America is to this problem that is in part ours, but is a global problem that needs a global solution. Mm.
I want to turn to the phones now, and first to Afton, Virginia, where Ned is calling. Welcome to the program, Ned.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. This
sure.
is a fascinating topic. I'm an adjunct professor at UVA, and I do give some lectures on related subjects, and I just wanted to take one of the calculations that I've done and impart it to you and your audience.
Okay. We're ready.
Okay. If you took the entire 6 billion people who currently live on Earth, and you converted them into a biomass, which is equal weight to other living things. At the scale of a globe, say, if you were holding a basketball out in front of you and it was the Earth, they would have the same biomass as 107 E. coli bacteria. You couldn't even see them except with a microscope. So the point I'm trying to make is that on the one side, you have this huge and pervasive and emerging impact on the planet. And on the other, if you go to a scale where you can actually see the Earth in front of you, we hardly even exist. So the leverage of humans is extreme. And that's one of the things that really amazes me, is that if we just get away from our own importance and significance and see our true size, then it becomes an even more frightening equation. Mm.
Ned, thank you. Dr. Sanderson, do you have a response?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I think, as I said earlier, you know, Paul Ehrlich said it's population times technology times consumption. That's the impact, right? And so, you know, if you just think back in time, you know, because of fossil fuels and because of our technology, we're able to do such amazing things that we weren't able to do before. Like, one guy with a bulldozer can do more than, you know, all the Pharaoh's armies in terms of changing the planet. And so, you know, I think we've been very good about developing our intelligence and developing our technology. I'm not sure we've been so good about developing our wisdom. And wisdom is really what's required now to make the kind of right choices, and right choices not only as individuals but as societies.
There was in a discussion we had in Washington, D.C., Jane, a couple of nights ago that Eric and I attended, somebody there described the last century of human developments as the frat boy phase because basically we have made enormous strides in technology and invention. But as he put it, we've been yanking open the boxes and throwing the stuff over our shoulders and thinking, you know, this is what we can do and look what we have here, and not paying any heed to sort of the destruction and waste that we've created. Mm. But I thought that was a great analogy because, of, you know, everybody grows out of their frat boy stage, we hope, and becomes a more responsible citizen.
Yeah, that's a great book. Oh,
yeah,
go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I just want to play a clip here from The Human Footprint about how appliances, it adds up, how many we use in a lifetime. Here it is.
Take a washing machine. Nothing to get excited about, but we depend on it, and then one day it breaks down. Or we just want a better one. So we throw the old one out and buy a new one. We'll do that 7 times. The same with refrigerators. We'll own 5 of them. And to keep our cool, we'll go through 7 air conditioners. We'll buy 8 microwaves, 10 TV sets, and 15 computers.
And Elizabeth, the information and technology footprint from computers to cell phones is also quite dramatic, isn't it?
Enormous, especially when we examine in particular in the documentary cell phones, because cell phones require a certain chemical called coltan, I believe, in order to make. And, you know, that is found in one African country on the other side of the earth. And the mining for coltan has had huge implications for the wildlife in that environment as well as for the human population. Villages have been decimated to sort of make way for the mining industry. All sorts of factions have sprung up as a result. There are guerrilla groups that are causing violence in that part of the world. So we never think about this as we whip out our cell phone or upgrade or improve or buy a new cell phone. And And the answer is simple. We're not saying to people you can't get a new cell phone or the best cell phone out there, because everybody knows they get better and better each and every year. But just recycle the cell phone. Don't just toss it, because those all the different minerals and elements that are required to make that tiny cell phone come from all over the earth and have huge implications in the mining of those. Mm. And by the way, we have to use a lot of fuel to fly them all to the factories and then the cell phones to our stores.
Dr. Sanderson.
I was going to say, sorry, there's this phenomenon called over-the-horizon consumption, which Elizabeth is describing, right? So if we go back in time, if we were, you know, two Native Americans living on Manhattan, we would have gotten all our resources right from around here, you know, from the waters and from the forests that were here on this island. But today, the resources that, you know, that we have for our breakfast, they actually come from all over the world, right? And so that phenomenon of over-the-horizon consumption means that it's actually really hard for us to kind of relate our consumption to its impact, right? Because it's actually happening a long, long way away, and it's actually also happening through a long economic change, right? So the guy that, you know, kills the gorilla and digs out the coltan in the Democratic Republic of Congo, trades it to somebody else, who 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 actually makes the cell phone, who finally gives it to the vendor, who actually gives it to us. Mm. And in that process, somehow we lose the connection of the actual stuff that's in our cell phone and what it means in the real world. Mm.
Let's get a call in before we go to the break here. Rich is in Stowe, Vermont. Rich, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. I really appreciate this conversation and the effort by ABC to work on this. But I feel like I don't hear the conversation and the inquiry going to where we use the most energy, and that's transportation. Hmm. I just feel that we should be more outraged at the miles per gallon we've been getting for the last 30, 40 years. I just saw a show the other night that said Ford's first mass-produced car got 26 miles to the gallon. Mm. And I don't buy that, oh, Americans want big vehicles. I don't buy that. I buy that the sophistication of marketing has made Americans think they want those big cars. I mean, why would you ever want four seats and a little tiny little payload in an SUV with a gigantic engine? You can't carry anything. It doesn't make any sense. We've been sold a bill of goods.
Rich, thank you. I'm going to turn this before we take the break to Dr. Sanderson and Elizabeth. Caller says, you know, we're not doing enough, especially with transportation in our cars, our vehicles.
Oh, I think that he's definitely got a point there. And actually, in part of the National Geographic special, we do talk we break down everything about cars and America's love affair for cars. And we're only 5% of the population. As I've said, we drive 30% of the world's cars, and we'll each own 12 cars in our lifetime. And I agree. I can't believe with today's gas prices, people aren't buying smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. And some people are. More Priuses are now available and affordable and electric cars. But right. I totally agree with our caller. It's a mystery to me. I haven't owned a car in 15 years, though. So.
Right. I mean, I think cars are a good example of a grassroots movement, right? So if you think back 6 or 7 years ago when hybrid cars first came on the market, all the American car makers are saying, no, nobody wants that, et cetera, just like the caller was saying. But in fact, if you wanted to go and buy a Prius, they weren't on the lot. Mm. You know, you had to wait 6 months to a year because the demand was so high. And it's continued to be at that high level, even though they're a little bit more expensive and so forth and so on. That's a really good example of how people are willing to pay for this sort of thing. But I think that only gets us so far itself, right? You know, our love affair with the car is also the result of government policies that for a long time have really facilitated us, you know, living farther from the places we work and be able to get there. There's a lot of hidden costs that go into that.
A lack of mass transportation in many American cities.
That's right. That's right. And so what we really need to do is not only make better decisions individually, but work as societies and as the government in order to provide those options for public transportation that is more fuel efficient, that meets our needs to get us to work, but does it in a way that's less damaging to the environment.
Thank you. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about understanding how each of us contributes to the big picture that we all know as global warming. And we're trying to think about it in the terms of what we can do to change our modern lives to make things better. My guests this hour are Elizabeth Vargas, co-host of ABC's 2020, and the host of a National Geographic special presentation called Human Footprint, which airs this Sunday. And Dr. Eric Sanderson, Associate Director of the Living Landscapes Program of the Wildlife Conservation Society. I'd like to listen to another excerpt from the National Geographic documentary. This one explains the global impact of simply keeping ourselves clean and looking good.
It's an ugly fact that Americans spend more on beauty than on education every year. Just take a peek inside your bathroom cabinet. How much did you spend to stock it? Now multiply that by a lifetime.
All those bars of soap, shampoos, gels, and cleansers add up.
If you were to win a lifetime supply of those products, this is what your bathroom might look like. 156 toothbrushes, 389 tubes of toothpaste to squeeze onto them. Here are all the bars of soap you'll use, 656 of them, and 198 bottles of shampoo.
I'd like to bring another voice now into our conversation. Colin Bevan is in New York. He is known as No Impact Man. His blog is noimpactman.com. He and his family conducted a fascinating experiment and tried for 1 year to leave no carbon footprint on the planet. Welcome, Colin. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So give us a slice of your life during that year when you were trying to have no impact.
Well, the idea was that we would cut our consumption of resources in every area of our life, from transportation to water use, to reduce our environmental impact. And then, because the idea was to have no net impact, and that's impossible, we tried to have positive impact, too, so that our little negative impact plus our positive impact would equal zero. And what I want to say is that what we discovered is that there's incredible opportunities for having a better life by making less impact, both at the individual level and the cultural level. So one of the things that we have to get out there in this conversation is that we have the opportunity to make our culture better and be happier. It's not all bad news. There's good news there, too.
Well, tell us what you did. On a practical level, tell us exactly what your life was like. Sounds very 19th century to me as I read about it.
It's not about being 19th century. It's not about living in the past. It's about taking some of the wisdom of the past and adding it to what we have in the present and making things even better. So, for example, instead of using carbon-producing transportation, we walked and we biked.
Right, but you live in New York City where that's feasible. Lots of people live in other places where you just have to drive to get where you're going.
That's absolutely right, and that's why it's important that each of us look at our own lifestyles and ask what we can do. But, of course, it's beyond lifestyle. Like, you talked a lot during the show about the question of changing our own individual impacts. But the other important thing that's really important is that we engage in our democracy and tell our political leaders that we want change at the corporate and government level. And one way to do that, because people are really frustrated, you know, do I make a difference in my democracy? And people do make a difference. And one way to do it is to go to onesky.org, which will help you to write letters to all the political candidates and tell them that you care about this environmental thing, which is onesky.org.
So some of the changes you made, you started eating food organically grown.
No,
locally grown.
My main emphasis was locally grown.
Within a 250-mile radius of Manhattan.
Exactly.
And no shopping for anything except that food. And in the course of that, you tried to produce no trash, right?
Absolutely. Oh, and yeah.
Except for the compost, which you had at home, right?
Yes.
And you mentioned the scooter that your wife, who, by the way, you dragged her into this kind of kicking and screaming, but she got on board and was quite into it.
She did. Because you see, what happened was, like, at first, this is not about us being bad and trying to get good. What's happened to us as a culture is that we've just developed a lot of habits. And back in the day when maybe we were a million people and we dumped something in the river, it didn't make that big a deal. But as we've grown and we dump things in the river and pour carbon emissions into our air, and we have a huge population, it's a big thing. So it's not about being bad and trying to get good. It's just about recognizing that our habits don't work anymore.
But when your habits include, as did yours for this year of the no impact life,
yeah,
no toilet paper, no dishwasher, no microwave, no TV. I mean, I think a lot of people out there listening will just say, holy cow, I can't do that.
Yeah, but it's not about everybody trying to do what I did. I was just living a lifestyle experiment. I'm not suggesting that everybody should do what I did. The purpose of the experiment was just to say, if I, as an average kind of New York City American citizen, try to consume fewer resources, will it make me happier or sadder? And the main thing that I discovered is that consumption of resources isn't what makes me happier. So you mentioned the TV. When we got rid of the TV, and we started, what happened was, instead of the TV being the center of our home, the dining table became the center of our home. Mm. And we started to spend more time together as a family, and that made us happier. Mm. Because we had no TV, we invited friends over, and we played charades, and that made us happier. So, sometimes consuming resources, that's some of the good news here, that actually we have a chance. Think of, for example, commuting. Commuting by car, some people commute 2 hours into New York City. Commuting by car causes a huge impact on our environment. Who wants to commute for 2 hours? Nobody does. Nobody wants to do that. So we can change our lives and our culture and our national infrastructure in such a way that not only does it make the planet happier, but it makes the people happier, too.
So during this time, and now that your year experiment has passed, what are some of the things that you have kept and incorporated into the life that, well, that you used to lead, that you're leading now?
So basically what we did was we asked what made sense, like what did we have that actually did make us happier? And one thing that we decided made us happier was the laundry machine.
Yeah.
And because we were sick of doing it by hand. On the other hand,
and washing those 2-year-olds' organic cotton diapers, I think too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we're never bringing back the air conditioner because the air conditioner has a huge impact. And it turned out we had like 5 bad nights over the summer. So there's no reason, and actually we don't like air-conditioned air that much anyway, so there's no reason to bring back the air conditioner. So it's a matter of what makes sense. Mm. We continue to ride our bikes everywhere. We continue to walk everywhere because, again, that makes us healthier.
Mm. Elizabeth Vargas and Dr. Eric Sanderson, our guest Colin Bevan mentioned the change at the corporate and the government level. Can you speak to that for a moment and the importance of that, the practicality of that?
You know, Eric and I were just talking during the commercial break, Jane, about the fact, following up on the car issue, that it might take something to really generate a change in this country on the line of what our European friends have done, for example. The mayor of London has imposed a tax on SUVs at the toll. So here's your toll booth, your normal toll booth, and cars pull up and pay, I'm going to make up this figure, a $2 toll, and SUV pulls up and has to pay a $5 toll. If you build into the cost of these big, inefficient, wasteful cars and SUVs, a tax to offset, for the government or different agencies to offset its environmental footprint, perhaps people will finally throw in the towel and say, even though I loved driving my SUV, I'm going to switch into something that's more fuel efficient and leaves a smaller footprint. There are a lot of people in this country who feel like our government is going to have to step in and start to assess penalties on items and devices and ways of life that are incredibly inefficient in order to persuade people, not on their own, because, money talks. If it costs me more, I'm going to take the cheaper version eventually.
But yeah, this is Colin talking. Do you mind if I just say it's not just about limiting ourselves? Because the other thing that we can do is we can invest in renewable and sustainable energy. So that it's not just about like paying a tax for driving your SUV, but that we're actually creating a huge amount of jobs and creating an industry that would make us market leaders around the world, because the whole world is going to be changing to renewable energy sources. So if we develop the renewable energy industry, how much better are we making things at home?
Dr. Sanderson.
Yeah, I think the question is, what do we use our wealth and creativity for? right? And I don't think we really think about that very much, right? We can do tremendous things because we live in this time of great communication, of enormous media, of power, a power in technology. But what are we using that for? You know, I think we're using it sometimes not very well. And so I think one way is to set out good examples, you know, and I think, you know, not everybody's going to want to do what Colin did, but he's doing a test, he's doing an experiment, which I think is helpful. I think working on the economics of it, right? I mean, it's actually a pretty remarkable thing, our globalized economy, that can bring us, you know, whatever, an SUV, and then fuel it from, you know, oil that comes from the Middle East and all the parts that goes into that car and all the things that go into making the road, and it actually works somehow. That's a remarkable thing. The question is, how can we get that remarkably efficient system, which is the free market capitalist system, to actually build in these costs that are to the environment. And I think, as Colin points out rightly, to our individual lives and our individual happiness.
Get a really good look at that consumption on this special, the National Geographic special that's called Human Footprint, airs this Sunday at 9 p.m. Let's go back to the phones. Lewis is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Hi, I have a few ideas. You know, I live in the suburb, and everybody wants to have a perfect lawn, so they use a lot of pesticides, and that goes into the groundwater, and it's part of an imprint that is unhealthy. It would be nice if we could convince people to have a normal lawn with regular weeds in it, or just use methods other than pesticides. Mm. The other thing is, when I was in Europe, I noticed that people would bring a mesh bag, which you can fold and takes no space at all, and that's how they went and bought their food in the supermarket. They didn't have plastic bags or paper bags. You had your own. And the third idea is that in the United States, we use a lot of plastic things and prepackaged things because we're always on the run. We go into the fast food store or seven whatever, we pick up the styrofoam and this, that, and the other thing, because we're on the run. We're working so hard that we're lucky if we get 1 week or 2 weeks off a year on vacation. I notice in Europe they have 6 weeks, and in France they work 35 hours a week. So they enjoy life. They don't have to push themselves like we do. And we do this in order to be able to do this, to be on this assembly line. We are actually using a lot of these products that are really detrimental.
Lewis, you bring up a good point, and I want to turn to Dr. Sanderson with it. Thank you for your call. He mentions the Europeans and how he gets a lot of his ideas about non-consumption from Europe. Are Europeans ahead of us on this, Dr. Sanderson?
I think in a lot of ways they are ahead of us. They're not as far as the world needs to go, but they are ahead of us. And I think it's because in America we have this idea of the frontier, right? That if we use up the place we are now, there's always we can just go over the hill and to the next valley, and there'll be some other place to use up. But actually, you know, if you take the sum total, the human footprint map, and show what it means for the planet, there are no more hills, right? I mean, there's no more additional valley to go to. There's no new place. And I think the Europeans realized that about, I don't know, 50 or 60 years ago, and they've been changing their lives ever since.
And those governments have imposed financial incentives or penalties even for people who don't come within the more economic lifestyle.
No, that's right. And that was supported by the people because they want to live. And I think, you know, like the caller said, in some ways, they're living more enjoyable lives as a result of that.
I mean, this is Colin speaking. If I can add, part of it is also because of the way the Europeans developed, because they're much older than us, and the cities and the towns developed before the car came along. So, and American cities often developed to accommodate the car. And what goes with that is that with living in villages where people are connected together, they have more community than we do. So again, it's this idea, if we can change our infrastructure to have, you know, small conurbations connected by public transportation where we can walk and ride our bicycles and talk to each other, we actually have a chance of having a better and happier life than we do making more impact.
Back to the phones for another call. Jim is in Meridian, Connecticut. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Yes, hello. I'd like to say that I hear a lot about conservation in many areas, large and small, but one thing I hear very little about is population control worldwide. We need to do that, whether it's through the UN or some other agency. And so far, I've only seen China that's approached that.
Jim, thank you. Dr. Sanderson?
It's a good point. And, you know, in fact, Elizabeth, I think, mentioned before this estimate that over the next 100 years, the world population might level out at 10 to 12 billion. And that's based on assumptions of continuing economic development in the developing world and also increased capacity for women to make rights and choices about their reproductive lives, right?
And rights that many women don't currently have today. And
exactly.
Unfortunately, the caller mentioned the policy in China of one baby per family. That has not proved to be quite as effective as many might have hoped. Many of the rich families in China are able to get around that happily paying penalties. So there are all sorts of social and political issues attached to a policy like that, as well as enforcement, to be honest.
Dr. Sanderson, yeah. I'd like to end here in our last couple of minutes. Elizabeth Vargas mentioned earlier just a couple of things you can do today, from lowering the thermostat a couple of degrees to replacing just one light bulb to save the carbon dioxide emissions. What would you say to people who are listening who say, I want to make a difference? How do I do it?
Yeah, well, I think actually most of the solutions I was just have come out in this hour. So one is do all the good things you can do, right? Do all, think about your life and what you want to do and make those choices. The next one is make those choices articulate in your community. So talk to your friends, talk to your politicians, talk to your leaders, make your buying decisions as well and make it known. And then, support the kind of transformational things we need to do, and there's, as one of the callers mentioned, conservation groups all over the world that are working really hard, including my own, based out of New York, the Wildlife Conservation Society, to try and make the world a better place, not only for people, but for nature as well.
Elizabeth, you have the last word here. Is there anything you want to add about the special human footprint, anything that just shocked you or that you'd like to get across?
Just that I think – I don't think anybody in this project wants to be a nag or a lecturer. We heard one caller comparing the American how hard we work, and we are slaves to convenience most certainly. But I think, we as a nation have been leaders and innovators from day one. We are a hardworking, innovative people, and I think all it takes now is for us to decide this is something that's important. And I think we can make a big difference, and hopefully just by seeing the impact we leave on the earth – each one of us, each single one of us in our lifetime, maybe people will think a little bit.
Elizabeth Vargas, co-host of ABC's 2020 and host of the National Geographic special, Human Footprint, airs this Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. Thanks so much, Elizabeth. Great to talk
Thank
to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Eric Sanderson from the Living Landscapes Program of the Wildlife Conservation Society. Doctor, thanks to you.
Yep, thank you very much.
And Colin Bevan, a.k.a. No Impact Man. What a great experiment. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.